impact and sustainability are two of the biggest buzzwords in business today, and even more so in the world of fashion. Brands are very much under the microscope and under pressure from all corners to commit to more environmentally friendly practices. And one entrepreneur creating a new blueprint to merge luxury and sustainability is Cressy Wessling, co-founder of Elvis and Cressy. Cressy launched the company in 2005 with her husband, James Henrett, also known as Elvis. From a 200-year-old converted mill in Kent, the company now gives new life to 15 discarded materials, including parachute silk and tea and coffee sacks, turning them into handmade accessories, homewares, and signature bright red handbags made from discarded fire hoses. 50% of the profits are then donated back to charity. To date, they have rescued more than 200 tons of material that would have otherwise gone to landfill, and each year is able to transform all of London's decommissioned fire hoses. They are also one of the original certified B corporations here in the UK, businesses committed to impact that balance purpose and profit. Most recently, Elvis and Cressy have partnered with the Burberry Foundation to reuse leather offcuts from the designer label, and have just announced they will this year donate 50% of their profits from the leather program to provide 3 scholarships to women to train as solar engineers with Barefoot College in India. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. For this week's program, I sat down with Cressy at Midori House to hear the story of Elvis and Cressy.
I finished university in December 99, and I went to Hong Kong, and I met an absolutely wild woman at a dinner party who offered me a job in a VC sort of 3 days later. And that was spectacular, because at that point I had no plan other than to avoid law school like the plague. Mm. So I was very, very happy to be offered a job in an industry I knew nothing about. Working for people I knew nothing about, looking at technologies I knew nothing about. It was wonderfully full of challenge and change.
What was that all about? I mean, you studied at McGill and were doing something totally different, but how was that journey for you professionally? Did that sort of change the course of where you thought you would end up?
Definitely. When I was at McGill, I studied politics. And at the time, I thought the best way for me to make an impact was going to be with a political career. So I was hell-bent on going into Canadian politics. And then over the course of the degree, I realized that I have a bit of a dictatorial personality and that working in a democratic environment might not suit my, let's say, patience or, you know, my mental strengths.
Well, we'll get into that because that's very interesting now that you do head a company. So we'll talk about what you're like to work for, perhaps. But I'd like to hear just a little bit more about that journey and how you came to London and started looking through landfills and at the sewers.
Yeah. So I worked for Amy and for this small VC for almost 2 years. And it was amazing. We were always investing in technologies, hard technologies, machines that did something. And it was the private capital of about 12 investors. And I was basically the due diligence person who ran around checking out these investments. And it was an unbelievable level of training that I got from sort of 12 very amazing investors who'd had careers in private equity and all kinds of things all over the world. And what it taught me over that brief 2 year period was that if you have a business, you can do whatever you want as long as you make enough money to keep the doors open. And what I also learned was that I wasn't interested in staying in a VC long term. And I certainly wasn't interested in just the pure investment space because there was no values in it. There was no morality in it. And I've always been an intensely moral person that wanted the world to be better. And at the time, this is, you know, really way before we had impact investing as an industry. That wasn't the lens that anyone was using to invest money. So that wouldn't have worked, me staying in a VC. When I left the VC, it was to set up a biodegradable packaging business, which was with a great business partner, great idea, but way too ahead of its time. You know, the first shipment of biodegradable packaging that we shipped to the UK biodegraded on the way here.
It's very efficient then.
It actually was biodegradable, but it wasn't really good at packaging. But it was an amazing startup experience for me. I really learned in that brief moment that for sure I wanted to run a company, or I wanted to be able to run with my ideas, whichever way that shook down. And then Elvis, who I'd met in Hong Kong, who's now my partner in life and business partner, he came back to the UK. So I came to the UK to check it out. And the things I'm interested in are landfill sites. So that's where I started hanging out.
And you eventually found some fire hose. I think you've told a story about training for the London Marathon and picking up a big roll of fire hose.
Yeah. So I went to a lot of landfill sites, and what you see is chaos, you know, the chaos of the consumer, let's call it, where everything is jumbled up, everything is mixed together. You've got tennis rackets, dog poo, nappies, all kinds of gross, disgusting waste, and it's mixed, which means it's lost all of its value. But I also started to see in these landfill sites beautiful streams of material coming in. And I knew if I could intercept them upstream that I might be onto something. So it was kind of like a long-term stakeout where I was looking for the materials that I found particularly interesting. Then I would stalk the truck drivers who brought them in and say, hey, where did you come from? And they would be saying, you know, like Yorkshire, Northamptonshire, Dorset, wherever they were from. Mm. Then you'd go to the industrial states and see these materials. And, you know, I saw sort of two things kind of happen at the same time. I saw a fire hose in this environment. And then I had a chance meeting with some lovely, lovely people from the London Fire Brigade and said, you know, what is the deal with the fire hose? Why would I see it in landfill? And they said, look, you know, it either lives till 25 years, that's its health and safety life, or if we get a catastrophic tear at meter 11 of a 22-meter hose, that's it. It's got to go.
Mm. And when you looked at this material, did you see its potential and what it could become, or were you just looking to sort of say, maybe I can help solve this problem of waste?
It was definitely the latter. Mm. I looked at it and thought, this is beautiful. I could sink my teeth into this. I could solve this problem. And also what I learned really, really early on from the London Fire Brigade was that it's a very bite-sized problem. You know, they produce between 3 and 12 tons of fire hose waste a year, which is, although it sounds like a lot, is quite a manageable amount if you're trying to understand it from the perspective of a micro enterprise or even just an initiative, even just a community service initiative. I thought, yeah, that's about the right amount of material for me to solve. Whereas in that year, 2004, 100 million tons of waste went to landfill.
Wow.
And 30% of that is construction waste. So it's not like I arrived at the landfills and went, ooh, I'm going to tackle construction waste.
Yeah.
That would have required hundreds of millions in investment, competing with the big five waste multinationals. And I was looking for something niche that it was ignored and that had, I don't know, that I fell for. It was a love story for sure.
So I've read or heard you say that people that knew you growing up would have never guessed that you would go on to make luxury handbags.
Yeah.
So how does that come about?
I think people that know me now find it really bizarre. You know, I was always a bit of a tomboy. I was never interested in fashion magazines. If you'd asked me what I wanted to be, I would never have said designer. I would never have said architect. I would never, you know, it was vet, politician. You know, there was never any aspect of what I had previously thought I would do that would lead me into this world. The hose told us that that's what it wanted to do. You know, and not in some very spiritual way, in a very academic way. Once we decided to rescue the hose, I spent a long time at the British Library trying to understand what hose is. You know, what is nitrile rubber? What's a nylon woven core look like? We went to North Yorkshire where the fire hose is made to see what it's comprised of and to try and understand what its best qualities are. And then we realized that some of the big global luxury brands are using similar materials. And that is why we're in this space, not because we had some huge desire to make luxury handbags. It's because that is the best possible outcome at the moment for fire hose, if you're talking about maximizing its value and really transforming its impact.
So you go on to create some items, some accessories, some bags. But I wonder how you saw the world of luxury and how you square that now. Because if we look at high-end, expensive handbags, they're top quality, the best materials possible. But when you're putting an item out there and calling it luxury, it's got some fade, it's worn, it looks a little bit different than your high-end handbag, let's say.
So this is really interesting because we never used the word luxury.
Mm.
In the beginning, we didn't use it at all. And we thought if someone or if people decide to tell us that's what we are, that's when we can start using it ourselves. And it was probably only, I think, 2011, 2012, we were named a Walpole Brand of Tomorrow. And Walpole's the British luxury establishment. And I remember when the cohort for that year was announced, it was at this cocktail party in a, you know, lovely Mayfair hotel. And the head of Walpole gave a speech and he introduced all the brands and he introduced us last. And he said, now I want to introduce you to Elvis and Cressy, who are the future of luxury. And I remember being terrified at the time because at that point, it was still just Elvis and I in the business. There was two of us. And I thought, if we're the future of luxury, this industry is in trouble. But also it gave us a profound sense of responsibility because we thought, actually, if you really break it down, maybe we are. And maybe that just means that we have to grow faster or collaborate more and spread our ideas. Yeah. For a long time, luxury has been the purview or the definition as provided by a certain set of companies. And I don't think that that's the way the world works anymore. I think now luxury is to be defined by the customer in the same way that you would say beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And for me, luxury is sitting down on a Friday night with Elvis, having pizza and a bottle of red wine and relaxing and cuddling up with our dog. You know, that's a luxurious evening for us. For girls in a large part of the world, it might be access to education. Mm. For an Arctic explorer, it might be access to enough ice to complete an expedition. You know, luxury means different things to different people. And I certainly don't think it should mean a specific kind of product that looks like a specific thing.
Mm. That's a fantastic definition. I want to look at the original deal as well that you struck for the fire hose, because right from the outset, this for you was going to be about giving back and about impact. Yeah. So when you went to the firefighters or the fire halls and said, I want this fire hose and I'm going to give you 50% of the profits back, yeah, they kind of thought you were crazy.
They didn't think they'd ever see me again.
Right.
You know, the first day I was in Croydon, and Croydon is where all fire hoses go basically to die. There's a team of guys there that will do everything they can to keep them in service. So all the kinds of repairs that you can imagine, cleaning them up, changing the couplings. But if there is this catastrophic tear, they decide, yep, this one is dead. And when I saw what was happening there and I saw the incredible work these people were doing, and they're all semi-retired fire service personnel, you get the idea that this is a fairly special organization. I just remember it was a kind of spot decision. I said, look, if we can make anything out of this, I want to give you half. And they thought it was funny. And at the end of the first year, we had £134 in the bank account and we gave it all to them because we thought splitting that in two would be fairly churlish, I suppose. But that was a statement of intent. And the Firefighters Charity is a small charity. It exists to make the lives better for fire service personnel and their families. It has a really strong focus on mental illness. You know, there's a lot of PTSD in the service. And it's an incredibly important organization. And if we can, through the work that we do, give back to that organization and create this real incredible circle, not just of the materials that we're rescuing, but of capital and of goodwill, then we'd be crazy not to do that.
Mm. So it sounds like you really had your finger on purpose and what the impact could be. But how did you go about actually getting that off the ground? I imagine this is where your experience in VC and briefly in startups came in.
I suppose it did, although we never went down the route of raising money. Mm. I think what I learned from a lot of the entrepreneurs that I got to interact with in Asia was that you either had to raise money or you had to make money, and you had to do one of the two relatively quickly. And what we did with the fire hose was just go out and try and find buyers. And the first customer we had ordered 500 belts to be sold at a concert in London, and it was kind of an unbelievable miracle. All these belts sold. And then we had enough money to buy a sewing machine. Elvis then learned to sew. And then we designed a bag. And I look back at this now and think, wow, we kind of did an analog version of a Kickstarter campaign, because Kickstarter didn't exist in 2005, 2006. But Elvis made one bag. And I took that bag all around London to whoever would listen to me and said, would you buy this bag? I'll give it to you for a 30% discount if you buy it now and it's available to you 6 months later, which is exactly the nature of Kickstarter. But we sold 200 bags that way.
Wow.
And that was enough to finance our whole first collection. And from there, we just kept growing and growing. We've always grown organically. So every time we, you know, do a big deal, we celebrate by, either giving money away or buying a machine that will help us.
Right.
For many years, we cleaned fire hose entirely by hand and only outdoors. We never raised money or took on debt. We were always waiting until we had enough funds to buy a machine that would help us. And that's how the company grew from being very much a business based in a bedroom to one that rented a garage, a bigger garage, a small workshop, and now owns a building and workshop in Kent and runs another workshop in Istanbul.
Tell me about that mill and the project that you're working on there.
Yeah, the mill was our savior. We found it in 2013 at a point when the business had outgrown where it was. We tried to buy a place, got rejected from that place. And we wouldn't have bought the mill unless we were desperate, because it screamed the money pit, if that's a movie reference that your listeners are familiar with. It's built in 1837. It had no heat. It had no power. It had 22 rotten windows. It had no planning permission. And what else was wrong with it? I mean, it just had nothing going for it except for that it was big and it was affordable. Luckily, we bought it in the summer, so the heat issue didn't come to play for a few months. There was too many things to love about it. One, it was available. Two, structurally sound. But when we found that we could rescue a building as well, you know, we just put our minds to it. Every morning for about 2 years, every morning we'd wake up early, work from about 6 until 7:30, 8:30 on the building. Then we would go to work on the business. And then at about 5, 6 o'clock at night, we would work on the building again. And yeah, we were doing sort of 40, 50 hours of DIY a week on top of our work schedule. But we now have this absolutely incredible workspace that people from all around the world can't wait to come and visit and explore.
You mentioned off the top about investing in technology originally when you were in Asia. I wonder now if you're investing in that and in looking forward for production, or more in people and reimagining production and skills and sewers. And are you training people that way?
We have an apprenticeship program for people to make, but also there's a huge proportion of our business and our time is spent on R&D. We're constantly taking on new materials. Now we rescue 15 materials. Mm. And in order to be good at that, you have to understand the nature of all of those materials. And we're not trying to ever turn them into something that's against the market. We're not ever trying to add any chemistry or chemicals to it, but we're always trying to understand what is the best possible future for this material. And our leather project is a case in point. You know, if you right now put 1,000 kilos of leather in the ground, if you landfill it, that cost to you is 410 pounds per ton. If we turn that leather into our leather system, which is a Lego-like system that allows you to take small scraps and make whole new hides and beyond, we can take that same 1,000 kilos and generate 100,000 pounds of revenue.
Wow.
So we're not ever trying to sort of just add a bit. We're trying to absolutely prove to the market the insanity that is at play when they are generating any waste of any kind. In order to get that huge value transition, you can imagine we spend a lot of time on R&D. So my time in Asia really did help with just trying to explore all kinds of new methodologies. You know, there's a lot of issues that we face in society which happen because we don't cross-pollinate enough. You know, you have people that sit in their silos. And I have visited the biggest lasagna factory in the UK. I've been to the landfill sites. I've seen where M&S make their sandwiches. I love going and understanding what kinds of technologies are out there, what kinds of workforces might be brought to bear on different kinds of materials, and how can we do something really new and really different, particularly in an industry that's so traditional.
Yeah. You've also talked about sort of the campaign talking point things where people are like single-use plastic and cotton earbuds and things like this that seem so minimal, but there seems to be a real lack of understanding outside of what you're doing and what others similar are doing in the actual impact we can have in actually cutting down on waste, but recycling, reusing things.
Yes. I think we rarely take a very broad view of our relationship with the world. You know, no one ever stands back and goes, okay, my day-to-day life is having these impacts. And certainly with single-use plastic, your day-to-day life is having a negative impact. Although it's making our lives easier now, it's making the lives of future generations virtually impossible. If you put a styrofoam cup into the water, it can exist there for 50 years. Then it gets broken down, swallowed by fish, eventually eaten by us. We don't understand the nature of the challenges that we're asking the natural world to bear. Mm. And one of the things that I absolutely love about being a B Corp, we were one of the first B Corps in the UK, is that it asks certain things of your business. And specifically, it asks that you change the constitution of your business to ensure that shareholders are no longer king. The environment and its people are at least as important as shareholders. Now, imagine capitalism with that lens. If all of the FTSE 100 companies had to abide by that rule, then we wouldn't have oil and gas companies
right.
in the FTSE 100. We wouldn't have huge technology giants that relied on selling a new phone every however many months to people who genuinely didn't need it, made of things called rare earth, you know, materials that are mined and causing all kinds of environmental degradation at the mine level, and then all kinds of environmental degradation at the recycling level. You wouldn't design phones the way they're designed, because you design them for deconstruction. You design them to cherish the raw materials in them so they could be used again and again and again in a circular economy construct. I suppose you could say that the biggest innovation Elvis and I ever came up with was a business model that had positive impact embedded in its DNA.
Right.
The more we grow, the more waste we rescue, and the more money we give away. There's no way for us to grow without increasing our footprint for good. And I think traditional capitalism has just massively failed there. Hmm. And it's a failure of creativity.
Where do you think the impact will be, though? It sounds like that sort of structure of capitalism and big companies is not going to change, but that people doing interesting things can make an impact and sort of change hearts and minds in the way that we do things.
Mm. Well, we've got some big companies moving toward being a B Corp. You know, Danone is going to switch over some of its brands. Some of the biggest, best performing Unilever brands are B Corp. I think that there's a lot that we can do to prove that this business model is more effective. You know, lots of people are saying, aren't B Corps wonderful? We are outperforming the British economy by a factor of 10, you know? Mm. So maybe we might just be on to something. Maybe, in fact, it's good for the bottom line to actually be a decent human being as a business leader. And not just a decent human being when you go home and hang out with your family and do your charity work, but a decent human being who takes their values to work with them and embeds them in their business practice. Mm. And maybe the world isn't going to change fast enough, but unless I am doing this, I have no platform to tell other people to change. The way we run the business gives us this amazing cloak of joy and happiness, almost an armor, which allows me to sort of challenge people and say, hey, we give 50% of our profits away, and it helps us double in size all the time. So what are you thinking just giving this money to your shareholders? That's insane.
You've talked about and mentioned earlier, touched on the collaborations that you're doing and also, I think, the offcuts particularly. I wonder about the leather, because that's a huge part of pollution and global waste. You actually have partnered with Burberry, which is quite interesting because of all the headlines that they made for burning their own fashion items. And
yes.
So how does that square? How do you line up with Burberry and what was sort of the purpose behind that?
So we started innovating with leather in about 2010, and Burberry approached us almost 4 years ago now, so a long time before this particular headline came out, and said that they really admired what we were doing with leather and could we look at their leather waste problem in particular. Now, at that point, I knew it globally minimum 800,000 tons a year. So we're talking a problem of a magnitude much, much bigger than the fire hose, you know, 80,000 times bigger. Could we solve that problem on our own? Probably not. So when you get approached by a company that is producing 9 tons of leather waste a month and wants to do something about it and wants to talk about it publicly, you can't help but be excited by that. You know, we had a lot of leather companies approach us before, but always with the stipulation that we could never tell anyone where the waste came from, which as a radically transparent business is slightly problematic for me. So the fact that Burberry wanted to be open about it and celebrate it and work towards not just a solution for them, but a global solution meant that there was a natural synergy for us. And it's not to say that Burberry doesn't have its issues, but I think it's an important signifier to the market that actually this news story came out about Burberry.
Yeah.
Why did this come out about Burberry? The reason it came out from Burberry is that it was in their shareholder meeting. It was information that Burberry published about itself. So this is an entire industry that has burned for a long time, and Burberry was admitting that it had a problem and is actually then admitting that it's going to be solving that problem and that this is the journey that it's on.
Yeah.
So I think of a lot of luxury companies, they're a natural partner for us because they are on the sustainability journey for sure. Are they as radical as we are? No. But they're a listed company with 10,000 employees.
Yeah.
It would be hard for them to be as nimble and as quick moving as we are. But I think they are going in the right direction. And certainly just the openness and honesty with which they approach these huge challenges is really heartening.
I wonder about brand and recognition. Obviously, when you started out, you've told a story before about someone bugging you for a belt that ended up in Vogue that really got you some traction there. But now that you're working with bigger companies, with working with all these different materials, I wonder what that recognition or brand means for you and what you can do.
Certainly, the brand gives us an incredible platform, not just, as I was saying before, to tell other people about the B Corp model, about being a social enterprise and the value of that. But it also means that for, let's say, for a long time, the green movement was considered really niche, and green products, people didn't have high expectations of them. So people never had the expectation that a green product could be the best product in the world, that it could be a high quality good, that it could be something that you would cherish for a very long time. And we've broken that myth entirely with what we've been able to do. And I think that just gives us permission to keep going out and keep busting other myths.
Right.
The myth of the traditional design method, where you conceive of an idea, go out and acquire the materials to achieve it, and don't really care about product death. What we are saying is that actually you can start with death, you can start with consequences, you can build something really spectacular that has, with respect to the leather in particular, the ability to be repaired and deconstructed and reconstructed through time to deliver the circular economy. Oh, and 50% of the profits from that go to renewable energy projects. What we're trying to say is that a business should be about multiple positive objectives. Mm. And the more success we have as a brand and the better our products are, the more we're able to spread that message. And certainly that's, I think, where we'll have the greatest impact over the next decade, is not just what we can achieve as a brand, as a small brand in isolation, but what we can achieve through partnerships and what we can achieve through influence.
How has this journey been for you in all these years of growing this brand? Because certainly you haven't ended up in the place you may have imagined, but it's given you quite the platform to do a lot, to have a big impact.
Yeah, and that I never expected, because the first thing we wanted to do was save the fire hose. And I would have been perfectly happy to do that completely quietly. You know, if I had, in my first several months of research with the fire hose, discovered that we could rescue it this way or that way, I would have just handed it off and said, here you go. But that wasn't what was required for the fire hose. We needed to make a brand. In order to make a brand, you have to learn how to communicate. In order to communicate effectively, you have to have the best story and the best product. So it was all iterative like that. But what I've loved about it is that we were never, it's never been easy. It's always been challenging. It's always been difficult, but it's also always been interesting. And it's always felt worthwhile. So even, I think, in your standard entrepreneurial journey, there's a lot of times when you might want to throw in the towel. But if impact is really at the heart of what you do, you don't have that option. You have to stick to your guns. You have to keep at it.
Is what you're doing, would you categorize that as sustainable? And is that sort of the most sustainable model a fashion house or a small designer could be?
Sustainability is always a journey. Yeah. You know, the most sustainable thing that I could do would be to down tools and stop doing anything at all and create a permaculture existence where absolutely I never moved anywhere or tried or I mean, it would be a totally different life. To be entirely sustainable, you'd have to live off the land.
Yeah.
And I don't think we are capable of that. So we've got to invent new ways of doing things. Are we the most sustainable luxury brand in the world? Probably. If there's one that's more sustainable, I haven't heard of them yet. Are there some other really, really spectacular brands? Absolutely. And hopefully, collectively, we have a shot at upending this industry, because fashion right now is just so insanely wasteful and bad at treating its workforce and supply chain that something truly does have to be done.
That's all the time we have on today's program. Thank you very much to Cressy Wessling for coming in to share the story of Elvis and Cressy. Do check them out online and stay tuned to this show, as we'll be speaking to the founders of several more certified B Corporations in the coming weeks on impact and purpose. The show was mixed and edited by Alex Port Felix. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.